The J-Talk Podcast. Yosh, 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 yosh.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you once again. And Sam, the K-League United guys haven't hit us with a cease and desist order yet. So it's time for K-League Corner. What were your major takeaways from the fifth round of the season?
Yeah, well, I don't think the K-League United boys should be worried by my cutting-edge analysis of the K-League. But, yeah, the big game, I think, this weekend was the kind of East Coast derby between Pohang and Ulsan. Ulsan just battered them. It was a quite embarrassing result, really, for Pohang. Lee Chung-yong, former Crystal Palace legend, he scored twice. So, yeah, they put up a very big victory. And Jeonbuk also got four goals. So those two taking their usual place at the top of the league. And yeah, I think going back on the question we got last week, it does look like they're settled now, and the behind closed doors scenario is not really affecting those two teams.
Yes, and a poor old FC Seoul are swept aside in the second half by Jeonbuk. A second straight home defeat for them since Sexdol Gate. Moving swiftly on then. A few pieces of housekeeping before we welcome in Alex Bishop to talk about FC Tokyo pulling the pin on its under-23 team ahead of the start of the new J3 season. So, Sam, on last week's episode with Sean Carroll, we were all cautiously positive about the J-League's announced return, but the day we posted, last Tuesday, I believe it was, we were shunted back to the reality of the current climate when news broke that Mu Kanazaki, on loan at Nagoya from Tosu, had tested positive for coronavirus. And then over the weekend, Grampus goalkeeper Mitch Langerak was also confirmed to have the virus. So I guess all we can hope, all we can do is hope that those two players are resting up safe at home and are feeling okay, and that there won't be a further outbreak at the Grampus training ground.
Yeah, absolutely. Thoughts go out to both of those. Hopefully they have a swift recovery. I know that Kanazaki was hospitalised, and I've not really heard anything too much after that, so hopefully he's okay. And equally, we haven't heard too much from Mitch Langerak. So again, yeah, hopefully they're okay. But I think it does show that the kind of adding of the testing is a good thing. You've caught these two people. I think Nagoya released a statement earlier today that said that no one else who had, they tested everyone else who hadn't been tested, and that those are all negative. So that's good. Hopefully it's contained and it is just the two people. Obviously you don't want it to be anyone, but to be able to have tested people to kind of stop that spread is a good thing. I think we're going to have more positive tests, I imagine, before the start of the league. But as long as it is just a couple of people and they are okay, then I think the league should be fine to start 27th and then the 4th. But just hopefully it's not the beginning of another outbreak and we can all get back to relative normality.
Indeed. Yeah, sending our best to both Kanazaki and Langerak, and hopefully they can make a speedy recovery. Well, a full recovery is obviously the most important thing in the first place. So last week with Sean, we talked about the resumption dates for J1 and J2, and indeed a commencement date for J3 that the J-League had set the previous week. Well, last week, of course, ahead of the release of the full fixture list for J's 1-3 next Monday the 15th, the J-League announced last week the end dates of the season for all three divisions. J1 is scheduled to finish on Saturday, December 19, with J2 and J3 wrapping up the following day. So, Sam, we had wondered whether the 2020 season might bleed into the early months of next year, but the J-League have put those thoughts to bed, at least for now, and again, touch wood that there won't be a further outbreak that would put that in jeopardy.
Yeah, it does look like they want to get it done and dusted this year, and I imagine if there is anything further, then it would just result in a shortened league season rather than extending it. It doesn't look like that's something they want to do. I just think it's going to be a tiring few months for the players. I think there was a report that said that the first three rounds, I think, would just be each weekend to let everyone ease into it. So then from round five, it will be onwards in J1, you're going to get weekend, midweek for the rest of the season. Plus, there was also the announcement from the AFC that they were trying to get the Champions League back running this year, which good luck trying to find anywhere to fit that in. I think it's it's not going to happen. I just really can't see them managing that. But yeah, we've got those, and the League Cup is still going in some sort of reformed format. So yeah, just a very tiring few months, for all the players involved and for all the people that have to cover it.
Most definitely. And you've just set me up for my next three topics, Sam. Yeah, I was going to move on to talk about the other announcement from last week from the J-League about the Levain Cup, the significant changes to the format of that for the 2020 edition. Of course, one group stage game had been played right back at the start of the season, but they've decided to scrap the entirely superfluous playoff stage, and they've excused J2 side Matsumoto from the rest of the group stage, which is a very, very sensible decision. And yeah, they were basically left with no other option, considering Matsumoto still have 41 J2 league games to play. So yes, they're out of their group, which I believe contains Urawa and Cerezo Osaka, and one other team might be Sendai, but I can't remember off the top of my head. Sorry. So yeah, basically the new format of the Levain Cup is that the four group winners and the best runner-up will advance to join the three ACL clubs in the quarterfinals. We're going to talk about scheduling a lot in this episode. Firstly at the start of the episode, and then with Alex later on as well. So yeah, where all these games will be squeezed into the schedule is anybody's guess. Will hopefully be revealed next Monday. But yeah, there's so many balls in the air at the moment, I imagine, at J-League House there with trying to put all these schedules together. I'm not sure if we'll get the full Levain Cup rundown as well. Of course, that final is usually played late in October or in the first week of November. The most likely dates for those late-stage Levain Cup games would appear to be during the international breaks that the AFC proposed last week. So they were busy with their fax machines as well last week at AFC House. So yeah, a couple of major announcements from them regarding the World Cup qualifiers and also the ACL, which Sam has already referenced. So firstly, the national team stuff. The AFC last Friday proposed dates for finishing off the second round of Asian World Cup qualifiers that were originally scheduled for March and June, I believe. They are October 8 and 13 and at November 12 and 17. Of course, Japan are one of five nations in Group F and have played four group stage games, meaning they will be scheduled to play on all four of those dates to complete the group. You might have forgotten, because I had, the other four countries in the group. They are Myanmar and Mongolia, who Wikipedia tell me are Japan's likely opponents in the October rounds. They're probably the ones that were scheduled for March, so they've just been slid over, but that nothing is confirmed, of course, at this stage. And the other two nations, of course, are Scrabble blockbusters Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, who the Samurai Blue will presumably face in November if, Myanmar and Mongolia are the October opponents. At the suspension of the qualifiers, Japan were a clear atop the group, a perfect four wins from four, 6 points clear of the Tajiks and the Kyrgyz, and they've both played a game more. So whether Hajime Moriyasu will have to field a full-strength national team for all four of those qualifiers is up for debate. Sam and will obviously cross those bridges when we come to them. But yes, further headaches for the J-League scheduling machine with AFC stuff starting to get factored in as well, I imagine.
Yeah, it's going to be difficult because you're going to have to imagine to get all the games in that they might have to play some league games during this these international periods, which is a shame for the likes of Kyogo Furuhashi, for example, and any other J-League player that's wanting to make a name for themselves in the national team, because maybe they'll have to play for their league club during that period, and you might have to name a European-based Japan squad, which is slightly annoying because I think these games are best for kind of experimentation, because realistically Japan are going through this first phase without any problems, so you'd want to test other players. So it might be a difficult balancing act between Moriyasu and the J-League clubs as to how many of their players he can take, so that'll be something interesting. But I think just in terms of the internationals, it's quite helpful this time around that the World Cup is going to be a Winter World Cup over in Qatar, so they've got the extra dates that they're able to shift these fixtures a couple of months or a couple of match days across. So they can still fit it in without too much trouble, and you haven't got to resort to three internationals across a international break or anything like that. So it should work out okay, but I think just for these first, well, these next couple of games, it's going to be interesting to see what sort of team is able to be picked.
Yes, most definitely. So, yeah, also from the AFC, as Sam has referenced earlier last week, the AFC stated its commitment to complete all 99 remaining games in the 2020 Asian Champions League before December, when the Club World Cup is scheduled to be held in Qatar. Again, that doesn't have a locked-in start date, but yes, it's scheduled for that month, sometime that month. I mean, that's got to be the logistical nightmare to end all logistical nightmares, but all we can say is good luck to them trying to figure all that out. Obviously, yeah, the J-League has got their hands full getting a schedule together by next Monday. Well, yeah, the AFC, well, the people there will just be pulling their hair out, I'm sure. Of course, the 99 games, they don't all involve Japanese clubs. And indeed, the three Japanese clubs in the group stage this year had got as far as anybody in completing their groups. All FC Tokyo, Kobe, and Yokohama F. Mariners had all played two group stage games at the time that competition took a breather. Of course, the Chinese league clubs have not played any of their games yet, I believe, or at least the three in the groups with Japan clubs haven't played any at all. So, yeah, massive headache on the cards there. And, well, I was going to bring this up later with Alex Sam, but while we're on the topic, we might as well do it now. I mean, once the J-League schedule is released next Monday, you've mentioned, yeah, it's basically going to be a midweek weekend pretty much all the way through. So basically any sort of gap in the schedule at, you know, in the later months of the season, we're going to have to presume that the AFC have been in touch with them and ask them to keep these weekends or midweeks free, do you think? Because otherwise there's just going to be too many conflicts of scheduling conflicts later on down the line, surely.
Well, it would make sense if they had. I don't know where they're going to fit these gaps in, especially if they are going for the 3 weeks at the start without the midweek games to let everyone in, because as I thought, I went through yet last week, there aren't many rounds where you can have without a midweek round to get all the fixtures in, especially if you're adding the Levain Cup in as well. So it's going to be very difficult. I guess they must have figured something out. But, yeah, I just don't really know, to be honest. I can't feasibly see it happening. I know that they might have all the intentions in the world, but you've still got other leagues around the world that have to rearrange their season as well. You've got to then try and coordinate that through all the teams that could be playing, and that's across the East and the West. I just think it's such a logistical nightmare. I can't see it feasibly working.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat, but yeah, they sound like they are serious about it, and obviously at this stage of proceedings, they most definitely are. But yeah, as you say, whether they can actually pull it off and get everything scheduled in the first place, and then get everything played is it looks like they're dreaming the impossible dream. But yeah, we shall see. Okay then, so I believe that's pretty much all of our housekeeping before we get to Alex.
I can jump in with some breaking news if you like.
Okay, all right.
I've got this released from Nikan. They've got the presumed first match card for J1's return on the 4th. It is all split kind of regionally, as we expected. They've got Urawa hosting Yokohama F. Marinos, Kashua Reysol against FC Tokyo, Kawasaki playing Kashima, King Kazu playing Consadole Sapporo. Sendai have got a fairly long trip actually to Shonan away, then Shimizu versus Nagoya, and Osaka Derby, Kobe versus Hiroshima, and then Oita Tosu. So looks a very exciting match card for J1's resumption.
Righty-o, yeah, hot off the press. That's very, very interesting. So it does seem that at least that first round is along the lines of the three groups of six that we'd heard rumoured, and so yeah, it sounds like that might be the case, at least for the early months. As they said last week, they were hoping to group teams together geographically, so very interesting stuff. And if it's rumoured and it's from a source like Nikan, then it's almost certainly true. These things tend to be so. Obviously you can't plan any trips listeners. But yes, you can plan your viewing schedule, start to plan your viewing schedules and the games that you really want to watch in the second round of the J1 season. All right, well, thank you very much for that, Sam. You definitely caught me off guard. But yeah, I'll start to process that as we dial up Alex Bishop. Okay, next, it's our pleasure to welcome Alex Bishop back to the pod. Alex, how are you? Keeping well?
Yeah, I'm very good. Thanks, Ben. It's been, a little bit tough being stuck inside the house over the pandemic. I've been confined to the couch watching classic World Cup matches on FIFA TV, you know, the YouTube channel. Various kind of bizarre FIFA career modes on FIFA 2020. But no, it's good that things are kind of coming out of it a little bit now. Things are opening up again, and we can look forward to the league starting again on July 4th.
Most definitely. And yes, Sam's just broken the news to me and the listeners at the end of part one there, Alex. So, Alex, what's your reaction to Kashiwa away, the first game back in the resumption, the J1 match day two?
It should be an entertaining one, I can tell you that. Tokyo usually have a pretty good record. I think we usually get a good result against Kashiwa in the league, if I remember correctly. I have been there once or twice watching Tokyo, but the funny thing with, well, most people, anybody who's been to Kashiwa Race or that Hitachi Dai Stadium as an away fan will know, it's very, very difficult to actually get a ticket for that standing section behind the goal. It's a great place to watch football, very old school, like maybe a lower league English team, like a League One, League Two team, no roof, just kind of like a terrace behind the goal, really close on top of the game. I don't know how many people, what the actual capacity is there, but it usually sells out almost immediately. And your only real chance is getting online to one of the kind of online auction sites and buying a ticket for like three times the cost is what I think I paid last time I was there. So my kind of conclusion is if there is going to be a game we'd play behind closed doors, I'm kind of glad it was that one.
Interesting. Yeah, I was just going to say, well, you'll be disappointed you can't go. But yeah, well, it turns out you probably wouldn't have been able to get in the first place. So yeah, every cloud, Alex. Yeah, that's very well said. And there you go. So yeah, whenever you're allowed to go back to the ground, and of course, the regular listeners know you very regularly attend Tokyo, both home and away. I'm sure you'll be banging the door down. But yeah, as you say, this is probably a decent fixture for you, at least, to have been scheduled in the first game back after the resumption. So we'll talk about Tokyo maybe in their prospects for the J1 season towards the end of our chat, if I manage to remember to ask you about it, Alex. But yeah, we primarily got you here to talk about the club winding up its under-23 team in the J3 competition before that season actually commences. We can get into why they've decided to make that decision, Alex. But what was your first reaction when you saw the news? For me, it was very surprising. How about yourself?
Well, honestly speaking, not entirely surprised. We do know that it was going to come to an end for all three of the under-23 teams, right, at the end of this season. Gamba Osaka, Sudetsu Osaka, and FC Tokyo. Given the fixture congestion situation that we've got, not just in J1, but right across the J-League, the JFA, and, of course, the Nadeshiko League as well, it's kind of not surprising for the reasons why they did it. We'll probably get onto in a little bit, but it's not surprising that they did that. I don't think it's quite high on the pecking order when the J-League and the JFA are concerned.
Okay, so Alex, FC Tokyo have come to this decision, and for a lot of us, it makes a lot of sense because we didn't think the team should have existed in the first place. But what are the basic reasons you think that they've decided to pull the pin ahead of this season getting going?
So the word on the street, on Twitter and other forms of social media, is that it's the lack of availability of stadiums, of these small stadiums where they play these games around Tokyo. So the FC Tokyo under-23, they play almost all of the games between two different venues. One is Nishigaoka up in northern Tokyo near Akabane, and the other one is Yumenoshima, which is out towards Odaiba, which is where the Olympic Village is supposed to be. Now, these two stadiums, it's not just FC Tokyo under-23 that play there. There's also, I think, in the Nadeshiko League, there's two or three teams, Nitere Bereza, that's the Tokyo Verdy women's team. They call that place home. There's another smaller team called Nittai. They play there as well. I think in the JFL, there is a Tokyo Musashino City. They're also playing their home games there sometimes as well. And you've also got a lot of universities and high schools who are using these stadiums. And in terms of scheduling, Yeah, it just seems as though it was going to be very difficult to manage for these various kind of bodies that are trying to play football there. So I think that, you know, the FC Tokyo under 23 is the one that had to go, with probably being the less relevant of the teams involved.
All right, fair enough. So, winding up the under 23 team, it reduces the number of clubs from 19 to 18 in the league. And most importantly, I suppose, it means there will be no buys this season in J3, meaning each club will be in action in each round, and the season is cut from 38 rounds to 34. Sam, we knew this was going to be, as Alex mentioned, we knew this was going to be the last year of all three under 23 clubs at the start of it. Should Cerezo and Gamba have also pulled the pin, do you think? That would have obviously reduced the season even further to where you're fairly easily manageable 16 teams playing 30 games each.
I think for the benefit of everyone, I think I don't think the under 23 team should have existed in the first place, and I think just to help everyone else out, and even themselves, I think getting rid of the teams would have been the best idea. It just, for Tokyo, it gives them extra players that are going to help during the league season, because you're going to play midweek, weekend, and all that sort of thing, so you're going to need the extra players. But the only thing I would say is that Cerezo and Gamba have use their under 23 teams a lot better, I think, than Tokyo. There's no, like, Daiki Niwa's playing however many games a season, Yohei Kajiyama, as we were talking about earlier. There have been players that have been used through that system, especially Gamba, when you look at the likes of Keito Nakamura and Ryotaro Meshino, who kind of made their way through the under 23 team in J3 and have gone on to European moves. So I can see the benefits, and I can see why Cerezo and Gamba will want these teams to continue, but yeah. Overall, I think, especially for Tokyo, it makes a lot more sense to get rid of them this season. And I think, generally speaking, I'd have thought the J3 teams as a whole would prefer not to have these extra games, especially during this situation.
Yeah, fair enough. So, Alex, you said, you didn't think the under 23 teams were fairly high on the pecking order at the J League House and at the JFA. How important do you think it was to FC Tokyo as a club? Because, as Sam says, he didn't like the fact that these three teams came into existence in the first place. And regular listeners to the podcast know that I'm very much on the same boat. But, I mean, we can talk about some of the major names that have passed through FC Tokyo under 23s over the past four seasons. But how important do you think it was to the club as a whole and the supporters as well? Obviously, it's difficult to get behind a second team, a second string team. I imagine only the hardcore of the support went to see the games regularly. But, I mean, you know, we often saw on a weekend on the team sheet two or three or four substitutes, and it was difficult to see how the club were taking it seriously themselves at times.
No, you're absolutely correct. Yeah, I agree with everything that Sam said. I think that FC Tokyo didn't implement or execute this whole thing properly. I think it could have done a lot more. I think it was kind of, you know, when it comes to some of the senior players, the first team players playing, Daiki Niwa, Sam mentioned before, I think that was more a case of pairing him up with the likes of Tsuyoshi Watanabe or Makoto Okazaki, who have now gone on to have, first team. Well, Okazaki's now on loan at Shimizu S-Pulse. I think it was more kind of like a mentorship system that they were trying to do there. But yeah, it seemed that it was almost kind of like, I don't want to say a retiring home, but with players who were kind of like out of form or we were about to move on, Kotaro Omori comes to mind, and indeed the Brazilian called Jaya. At the end of last season, just before those two are about to be moved on, they were put into the under 23 team. Almost kind of a way as kind of giving them game time, keeping their fitness up and advertising, those players to any kind of would be, interested party who'd come in and try and take them away from us. Not so much, as a method of bringing through a lot of young players, although we do have a few stars that have come through. It's nowhere on the scale that, the Gamba or Cerezo did. So, in terms of importance, I'm sure it made them a little bit of money, from a commercial standpoint for these games that they'd have, up at Nishigaoka on a Sunday afternoon. I think they got enough fans and enough interest from sponsors and things to kind of make it profitable. But yeah, it was a very kind of mediocre effort, would be my opinion. But as a concept, I wouldn't say I'm entirely against it.
Fair enough. I mean, they arguably had the best kits at the club as well, Alex. So some people will be disappointed to see them go out of circulation. I saw a few people mentioning that on Twitter shortly after the announcement. I think, yeah, they basically shut. They put the shutters on the under 23 merchandise store pretty much the next day, didn't they?
Yeah, they've stopped producing them. I think they'll still have them in Kamo Soccer, the big football goods store in Tokyo. But yeah, they'll probably sell out pretty quick, I think. They're very expensive as well. I think they go for about 20,000 yen. It's like $200, something like this, because they are really, they don't do like a replica version. It's all authentic, right? But yeah, I imagine a lot of people will be queuing up to get what's left of those the under-23 merchandise, for better or for worse, you know.
Do you think, just with the, because there's obviously a lot of players registered to this under 23 team, and not all of them are going to go into the first team for this season, do you see a kind of large scale like loan out to go to J2 and J3 clubs, or do you think these will filter down to like more regular youth teams in FC Tokyo?
You would think that that was part of the purpose of it, right? To kind of bring a few players through who would never play for FC Tokyo but be loaned out or passed on to maybe J2 or J3 teams. Some of them I cannot see ever going into the first team at FC Tokyo. I think they'll hang on to a lot of them for depth purposes this season. But yeah, for sure, I wouldn't be surprised if we start to see a lot of the kind of some of the newer guys who haven't really played that much going on loan to various clubs around the J League, maybe even the JFL in some cases. Yeah.
Well, I was actually checking, Alex, because I thought, yeah, all of these players who would regularly feature for the under-23s now being available for the first team could actually be a fairly significant advantage for Tokyo, considering the what's certain to be a very cluttered fixture list. But then when you actually go through the first team squad as a whole, there are 35 players in it, including a lot of the players that would feature for the under-23s, and that's actually not a very significant number compared to some of the other teams. I mean, Gamba, who we've mentioned, seemed to have taken this more seriously and done a better job of bringing young players through. I mean, they've got close to 50 players in their first team squad, and I mean, obviously a lot of those will be teenagers who aren't ready for the first team. But I mean, I don't know whether they're going to be able to afford to loan players out, because most J1 squads seem to be fairly bloated these days around the 30-35 player mark, and I would imagine that while they're not all guaranteed to play massive amount of games this season, for depth purposes they're probably going to have to keep most of them around.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I think so. I mean, we're going to be playing a lot like midweek, Sunday, it'll be Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday type of pattern. So I think we're going to have to. We won't have any choice but to keep most of them on board, at least for this season. And we'll have to see what we can do. I mean, I don't know if there'll be a round of transfers mid-season this year, but certainly at the end of this season, maybe there'll be a little bit of movement then.
It might even be the case that, say, I don't want to rule FC Tokyo out of a title push at all, but say if you get to around October and it's quite clear that maybe a title push isn't on the cards, and obviously there's no relegation for anyone to worry about, so it might be a case where you could just start playing these youngsters, give them J League experience when there's not really any pressure on anyone to finish in any sort of position. So I suppose you could see the likes of Bagunagande or Shuto Abe get a lot more game time this season just because of the lack of pressure on the teams.
Yeah, for sure. Not only that, I think it's a good idea, right, to give these guys, a run out. And I think, and Bagunagande Kashif, I think he's, one to look out for the future. So for sure, we'd be looking to like rotate him often, probably with Ryoya Ogawa. Shuto Abe, I'm sure he'll feature more and more. It's definitely a good opportunity to give these guys real, real playing time this year, I think, given the fixture list.
Indeed, indeed. All right, well, so let's give the listeners a potted history of FC Tokyo under-23s then. Yeah, so alongside Gamba and Cerezo under-23s, they entered the J3 for the 2016 season, of course, following in the footsteps of the J-League under-22 selection squad. So, yeah, under-23s, they made their bow in 2016, and I guess until the last three games of the season, when a certain Takefusa Kubo made his debut for the club, but coming off the bench in the final three games of the season, probably the biggest name to still be at the club and in the first team squad is Ryoya Ogawa, the left back who Alex has already mentioned. But yeah, I mean, you could tell very much from the off Tokyo's intentions, whether that's the right word, or their limitations in terms of being able to field a full squad of under 23 players, because, you know, the 40-year-old goalkeeper Tatsuya Enomoto made quite a few appearances in the 2016 season. Yohei Kajiyama did as well, and it was basically now Hiro Ishikawa's farewell tour as he looked to get back for a final few games with the first team. He did make a few appearances with the under-23s. Then in 2017, of course, Kubo had set the record for the youngest player in J-League history late in the 2016 season. He then became the youngest goal scorer in J-League history early in the 2017 season when his goal beat Cerezo Osaka under-23s at 1-0. Kubo, of course, made a total of 34 appearances for the under-23 team before he left for Yokohama F. Marinos on loan in the second half of the 2018 season. Of course, he came back to Tokyo in 2019 and did extremely well before leaving for Real Madrid June or July, wasn't it, of 2019. So it goes without saying, Alex, that, Kubo is the most famous alumni from FC Tokyo under-23s, but who are some of the other, maybe the listeners might not be too familiar with, some of the other success stories, you think? Some of the younger players who have cut their teeth in the under-23s and gone on to feature for the first team.
Well, there haven't been a lot, to be honest with you. I think the most prominent one is Ryoya Ogawa, who we just mentioned. He's now kind of cemented his place in the first team as a regular starter. If we look at the young centre-back, Tsuyoshi Watanabe, he broke into the first team last season, but would we call him an alumni? He only featured four times for the under-23 team. He got most of his his youth playing experience at Chuo University. So I'm not sure four games for the under-23s really kind of qualifies him as an alumni or not. Mm. Certainly there's a few. It's kind of interesting because right now we've got some good players coming through. There's like three or four quality players who I'm quite interested in. I think he really wants to look out for the season coming. It's probably the best time right now for the under-23s players that have come through. A notable one for me, probably my pick, is Kazuya Kondo. He's a young attacking midfielder, very, very small and kind of like really kind of silky smooth, great moving attacking midfielder. Kind of echoes of Shoya Nakajima a little bit. Ooh. I think he did actually come on to substitute against Shimizu S-Pulp the first game of the season. I remember seeing him with the under-23s last season when he first broke in. Again, he didn't have too many games for the under-23s and still hasn't. But I remember looking at him and thinking, this guy's really got it. He's kind of a level above J3. His movement's excellent on and off the ball, his sense of the game. He's a little bit small, so there's no physicality there. But in terms of like a playmaker or kind of an inside forward, I think he's really going to be one to look out for. Shuto Abe, he is kind of the special designation player, right? We took him while he was still at university. Again, he's only played a couple of games last season for the under-23s, but already he's had his J1 debut. Kind of, centre midfielder, playmaking type of player. We mentioned Kashif with the unpronounceable name, and I think Sam did it much better than I can. I'm very embarrassed to say. Bangonegande, right? I think this guy's actually had his... part Ghanaian, part Japanese kid, right? He grew up, born and raised in Japan, and I think he's had his debut for the Japanese national team at under-18 level. A couple of caps, I think. He's going to be really good left-back. One of these really attacking type of left-backs, like to get up the pitch, overlap with the left-sided midfielder. I think this kid actually got an assist last season in the Cup, the Louvain Cup. Was it the quarterfinals against Gamba? I think when Diego scored, he put in a cross and Diego just buried it at home. I'm not sure if it was him or not. I think it was, so don't hold me to that. So he's also another one that would be good and like a natural kind of rotational player for Ogawa when needed. And of course, we also have Taichi Hara up front. Now, I think he scored 19 goals in J3 last season, which made him the top scorer, if I'm not correct. I'm not sure if we have anyone who covers the J3 that extensively, but I think he went out for the top scorer. He has had his debut for the first team in the ACL this season, and unfortunately got a red card. I think that was against Perth. we'll have to give the kid the benefit of the doubt, and you know, we'll go again when the suspension's up, I suppose. But yeah, he's like a really, I actually met this guy at a training session once, very big stocky guy for a Japanese guy, so I think he's going to be one to watch. Hopefully he can take that momentum, take that the confidence he's got in the under 23 so far, bring it over to the first team. Although it will probably be very difficult for him to get a place with the attack we've got. We have some good attackers, some good forward players. So, but I'm sure somewhere in this kind of big mess of fixtures that we're going to have to sort out, he will see his time on the pitch. So just going back, you know, who we've had, you know, obviously Kubo's the most famous name, but I kind of, for me, did he really learn his game at Tokyo? I don't think so. You know, he was in Barcelona, and before that, he always had a lot of natural talent. The under-23s was kind of his vehicle, right, to his to the career he's going to go on to have. But yeah, I think probably he's the most notable one, like you say. Orgao, we have. Other than that, it is kind of tough to see anyone who's actually made it into the first team who we'd call a success. Yoon Soo, the young Korean attacking player. He did quite well for the under-23s. He had a kind of okay, mediocre loan spell at Vispa Fukuoka, came back to us, had a little bit of a try in the first team and didn't really break through, so he ended up back in the under-23s. And now he's over in Korea somewhere. Maybe he's on your radar, Sam. I'm not too sure.
I haven't seen him knocking about.
But yeah, he was one that kind of impressed me a little bit. His first appearance for Tokyo in the first team was quite a few years ago, actually. And he did score. I think he scored the winning goal against Iwata, Jubilo Iwata. It's kind of one of those goals. It's kind of the worst thing he could ever do. The expectation was so high, and he didn't really do anything after that. So, you know, he wasn't really a success, and he kind of gone. We've given a few foreign players, a few Brazilians, a run out. Arthur Silva started in there for a little bit, and now he's kind of a rotation player for the first team. Scored a magnificent goal against Kobe last season, but hasn't really done anything else since. So, you know, the jury's still out, I think, on that guy. He's, again, a little bit hot and cold. And there was Lippi Vamoso, who was the Brazilian, right? He's actually playing. He's actually seen a lot of game time in the Belarusian Premier League at the moment, and I think he scored a few goals for second place Torpedo Belaz. With nothing else to do, I've been watching that league continued all the way through the pandemic, right? All the way through the lockdown. So, yeah. So that's kind of it at the moment. There's been a few loan spells. Like Rei Hirakawa, I think he's had a few. He was down at Kagoshima for a little bit. Now he's back with us. I think he's played quite a few games for a player that's, he's only 20 years at the moment. I kind of got everything here. So, yeah, he played like 36 and 2 goals for our under-23, 7 games at Kagoshima. And in J1, he's played a total of 20 times and scored once for us. So for a kid of 20 years old, which is pretty young in Japan, you know, it's not a bad CV so far. So maybe he's one to look out for the future as well. And we also have on loan at Shimizu S-Pulse, under Pete Klimemski. I probably pronounced that wrong, but Makoto Okazaki is the centre-back. He seems to impress quite a lot, and he's played 21 years, he's played 65 times for us and scored 3 times as a defender, you know, for the under-23s, of course, and he had his league debut last season, total of 5 appearances and scored once, I think it was against Jubilo, third to last game of the season, something like that, so he, you know, could have a promising loan spell, and we'll have to keep an eye on him. So that's a few of them, but I don't think anyone's really gone on to make any waves anywhere at this point. Mm.
Yeah, certainly not along the lines of some of Gumba's illustrious alumni. And yeah, Alex, you're right about Hara. He was the J3 Golden Boot winner last year, and I was hoping that Kenta Hasegawa was going to throw him on as the wild card last year in the final game of last season against Yokohama, when obviously we faced Mission Impossible, having to win 3-0, and Diego Oliveira, certain to miss the game with a knee injury. I thought, well, why don't you just throw this kid who's been scoring a lot of goals in J3 in from the start and just see what happens? Of course, he was understandably more cautious than that, and that's why I'm not a J-League manager. But anyway, don't sell yourself short. I thought your pronunciation of Bangunagunde was very good there, and it doesn't matter if you say it quickly, then nobody can catch what you say anyway. So you've done well, you've done well. Yeah, anyway, it's Bangunagunde, definitely one to watch for maybe parts of this season, as you say, if he's called on to spell Ogawa. And yeah, I mean, it's not a great record of players, obviously Kubo excluded, but yeah, he was obviously going to make his name regardless of how many appearances he made for the under-23s. But I guess it looks okay on paper when you see that in the current first-team squad of 35 players, there are 12 youngsters, not including Daiki Niwa, of course, who have made over 20 appearances for the under-23s. So don't worry, listeners, I'm not going to name them one by one. But yeah, several of them Alex has mentioned there in his last answer. So they have brought some players through, but yeah, Alex is right to say that Ogawa is probably the biggest name remaining at the club, and I guess, yeah, that's somewhat of an indication, Sam, of the fact that, yeah, while it's definitely worked out for some, and I did get in touch with Alan Gibson for some information on the Gumba side of this, and he's very satisfied, obviously, with the way they've brought players through, and the likes of Takahiro Koe and Leo Takaya, who are still you know, in and around the first team or out on loan with the expectation that they'll be back either later this year or next season and, you know, be pushing for a first-team place. So they've obviously done a lot more in that regard than Tokyo. But, you know, considering for how seriously they took it at times, I guess 12 players, you know, graduating, if you like, to the first-team squad is a reasonable enough return.
Yeah, it's not bad. At least at Tokyo, you get to use them at Gamba. They come through the under-23s, play a handful of games for Gamba, and have suddenly disappeared. So they don't really get to reap much of the benefit that they got from Meshino getting so many games for the under-23s or whoever it might be. But yeah, I think Gamba, I'd say, of the three, have done the best. I think there's so many players that are in that first team. It helps with Miyamoto as the manager, who has looked to bring in those young players and just give them game time straight away. The likes of Yuya Fukuda has actually played quite a lot of games for Gamba. He's kind of been the stalwart of that under 23 crop, if you like, that has made his name for the first team. So yeah, I think they've done it exactly right. Tokyo, I don't think it's the worst record in the world. It looks a little bit worse when you mention those names, the older players that are getting game time. Like, why wasn't Go Hatano, for example, playing the majority of games in goal? What, I don't see the point of Enomoto at that age. But I think, yeah, Watanabe is a good player. Obviously didn't play too much, as Alex said. But I don't think it's the worst record in the world. And yeah, it is kind of ironic when Alex says that this year is arguably the best year for having a under-23 team. Because as he says, there are a lot of good players that have had bits and pieces of games, Levan Cup, ACL games. So I'm looking forward to seeing the likes of those players, especially Shuto Abe and Kondo, as you mentioned. Very good, exciting, dynamic players. So I think there's a lot to look forward to for Tokyo this season if these younger players get a lot more game time.
Yeah, most heavily. All right, so yeah, that's the end of that then for in terms of FC Tokyo and their under-23s. So Alex, while we've got you here then, there's obviously going to be, yeah, as we've referenced several times already, the fixture congestion is going to be suffocating at times for these players, especially as Sam says in part one. Yeah, it's rumoured that the clubs will be given a week in between games for the first 3 weeks back to, as was said, you kind of ease them back into it. And then it's going to basically going to be midweek weekend for the remainder of the season, of course, with the AFC saying they want to get the Champions League played as well. So, yeah, in a nutshell, how do you think the clubs, and obviously our club FC Tokyo that we both support, how do you think they're going to be able to handle it, especially through the brutal months of summer? It's going to be it's obviously a massive test for the players, for the support staff, obviously with the threat of a reoccurring outbreak of a coronavirus hanging over everybody's head every single day. How do you think it's going to pan out? I mean, do you allow yourself to believe that it's going to pan out as is basically currently constructed?
Well, who knows? I mean, with the ACL and whatnot, but I think the league will pretty much pan out as they plan, right? I mean, but yeah, it's going to be a very grueling kind of onslaught of games of many different competitions. I think conditioning is going to be key, right? I mean, a lot of fitness. They're going to have to really work on the fitness and making sure that, you know, they've got players and replacements for players. You know, really, obviously not everybody can play every game. They're going to need to have like backup ready for each single position, particularly in attack and these side backs as well, these wing backs who do a lot of running up and down the wing. Who knows? It's going to be very difficult to manage. We're going to have to take it game by game, I think. And we'll just have to see how they go. It's going to be pretty tough, and I'd hate to think what would happen if we get an injury to a key player. That could really kind of put a damper on the season indeed. And giving a lot of game time to these younger guys, that's going to be, key, I think. We're going to have to get some of these guys playing and playing quickly, maybe against some of the weaker opposition. And I don't want to sound too kind of complacent or anything there. But we'll have to have a look and see what kind of games where we're going to be like more of a kind of physical challenge for us. What kind of games will we be sitting back a little bit more? This kind of thing. And just kind of take it as it comes, I suppose. But yeah, I wouldn't envy any team in the J-League at the moment and how they have to manage this.
You mentioned there about the hopefully not getting injuries and whatnot, but kind of one of the benefits of the stopgap kind of at the start of this season is you're going to get Nagai back, and Higashi, who missed the first few games of the season as well, he's back. So how would you ideally set up that front three, front four, as it could be? Because we saw the kind of three-pronged Brazilian attack in the early stage of the season. Would you stick with that, or do you move Nagai left or Higashi left? What would be the ideal solution for you?
Well, for me, I'd keep them. I'd keep the three Brazilians up there. What we saw at the beginning of the season, I thought, was very good. There was a lot of synergy. They were working well together. Higashi, I probably wouldn't. If we could keep him out of the first team, I would. I don't think... the guy hasn't really... I mean, what we saw last season and stuff, I really don't know what he offers, to be honest. I mean, I don't really warrant himself a first-team place. The shape's a little bit different now as well. So I don't know how he'd fit in. I think, you'd stick him out on the left, I suppose, but he's not really kind of, I've never really seen him do anything in front of goal. He's a very good kind of, speedster, right? If you give him the ball, he can, in a counter-attack, one second he's up the end, other end of the pitch, and we've got a really good lethal chance there. So, he could kind of come back in. I'd put him in for a Dialton, and he'd have Diego up front as the number nine, maybe Leandro out left, something like this, and then the guy out right. It adds a little bit more depth, I'd say. So it's welcome that we're kind of starting late in that respect. Having all these fixtures bunched up, you can only worry that, something else is going to happen and we're going to have to look at, fixing shape again somewhere. To answer your question, I'd stick with the three Brazilians up front. That's what I'd go with.
Okie dokie.
Well, yeah, I mean, the only thing that's set in stone, though, Alex, is that you know that if Keigo Higashi's fit, he's going to be in Kenta Hasegawa's 11, and none of us can understand it, but he's the captain, so he has to play. So I don't know where he's going to squeeze him in. He might, the mind boggles. I frankly can't understand it myself, but...
He's not going to fit the shape, I didn't think. Is he more, when we were playing like a 4-4-2 or a 4-2-5-1 type of thing, and he's kind of like further back in midfield... I noticed last season he did a little bit more defensively, right? So I don't think he should be playing as a forward. I don't know where to play him, to be honest. Maybe in the centre of midfield, something like this. But yeah, who knows? Hopefully he doesn't fit the shape anyway.
I think in pre-season he was kind of playing the kind of number 10 role in behind the main striker. But again, a lot of your key players were injured for periods of that pre-season. So just imagine the game passing him by. It's been, as you say, it's quite a dynamic kind of front three that you were playing with, and Higashi just does not fit that role at all. So, yeah, I think he'll be wedged in there, and I think it'll be to the detriment of the team.
Lovely.
Just to put a positive spin on it for Tokyo fans.
Yes, indeed. Oh, well, actually, yeah, Sam, I was going to come back to you on this. So, was it last week with Sean? You mentioned that you'd crunched some numbers and you'd worked out exactly how many match days you think might be free, a midweek or weekend, once the league resumed on the 4th of July, or was that a couple of weeks ago? I can't remember. It might have been last week, though, I think.
It was last week. I did some kind of basic maths based on what I thought the end date was, and I think I got that about right, for the end date being the 20th, I think, of December. So let me try and find it here.
You probably had factored in that it'd be a midweek weekend right from the start, though, probably, didn't you?
Yeah, that is the thing.
Yeah, because I wouldn't say I crunched the numbers, but I wrote some stuff out on a piece of paper today, and basically with if we presume that rumor is correct and that match day 2 will be played on the 4th of July, match day 3 on the 11th, and then match day 4 on the 18th, and then they launch into midweek weekend for basically as long as they can before all the players drop dead. There are basically from Saturday, July the 18th, through to the scheduled final day of the season on the 19th of December, there are 20 Saturdays available. That's not including the two in between the proposed national team breaks. So technically 22 if they play on the Saturdays between national team games. But that's usually not the case, of course. So for the sake of my my numbers, there are 20 available. And obviously with the midweek, the national team games taking place in midweek with Thursday and Tuesday match days, there are 18 midweeks available. So yeah, once match day 4 is played on the 18th of July, they have to squeeze in 30 J1 games. For FC Tokyo, Kobe and Yokohama, they have to squeeze in 4 ACL group stage games. And of course, the Levain Cup teams, they have to squeeze in the remaining 5 group stage games, except of course for the teams in Matsumoto's group. So yeah, basically from the resumption, Alex, Tokyo have to play 33 J1 games. They have to play at least 4 in the ACL. Obviously, we hope they'll be playing several more than that. Could be up to as many as 7 more, of course, if they stick to the usual format of round of 16, quarterfinal, semifinal, then final. And, of course, there will have to be a two-legged Levain Cup quarterfinal played as well, with possibly 3 more games to come on top of that. So yeah, I'm sure your head is spinning with these numbers as mine was as I was writing them out. But basically a minimum 40 games, possibly pushing 50 games to be played in a 6-month span from the start of July until the late in December. So yeah, basically, I don't know if I have a question out of this, but yeah, as good luck to basically everyone involved and supporters as well, because we're gonna definitely feel the burn as well, I think.
Oh yeah, for sure. That's gonna hurt the pocket for sure. All those games coming up at once like that. It's gonna be a horrendous kind of run of football, right? I mean, it's going to be very interesting to see how teams manage it. I suppose that the 5 subs thing is going to go some way to help to alleviate the pressure a little bit of the strain on the players. But yeah, I mean, and who knows how it'll pan out and who manages it well and what happens later on in the season and things. But I mean, unprecedented times we're living in at the moment.
Yeah, I just think it makes so much sense, this theory, to have no relegation, because it's so unprecedented, this schedule. No team was prepared for it going into the season. Like, some teams, I know a 35-man squad seems like enough, but there are teams with less than that. They're going to be really stretched to the bone, I think, especially the likes of Tosu, who are losing players anyway because they can't afford them. They're going to have to be playing youth team players, I think, for large parts of this season. So it just makes sense that it's not necessarily fair to have anyone punished because of this scenario. So I think that's the one benefit I can see, and it's going to be make it interesting from a sporting context when teams have nothing to play for after maybe even like 15-20 games. You think, oh, we've got to do anything this season. So hopefully that just, for a neutral, it just brings a lot more exciting all action games. But again, with the schedule, you could just see teams just kind of like really slow, especially some of the summer games where you're playing 30 degrees. This is your 7th game in a row, like constantly. I think it's going to be interesting to see how these games pan out. And yeah, I just feel for the players, really. I think they're going to be absolutely shattered.
It's pretty tough anyway, right? I mean, a regular season into these summer months. I remember a game down in Kobe, I think it was 2016. We got hammered. I think it was 4-0. And this was before like the Iniesta era. And I think in Tokyo, we had 2 players who suffered sunstroke during the game. I think Maruyama, who's now at Nagoya, was one. I forget who the other one was. But yeah, I mean, it's a really tough, probably the worst time of the year, actually, to have fixture congestion, now that I think about it.
Yeah, and it's going to be even worse for J2 with the amount of fixtures they play. I have no idea how that's going to be fit in. I think Sean Carroll was saying that they're trying to get this break at the start of the season for J2 as well, but that just leaves so little gap for extra breaks during the season for that J2 schedule. And great news for Matsumoto, they've managed to avoid the Levan Cup, because I think that would be an almost impossibility logistically.
Well, yeah, I mean, they simply, I don't think they would have been able to schedule it for them. It's just, it's frankly ridiculous. I mean, yeah, not to go into, again, too many numbers, but basically, yeah, the way I worked it out, there are 8 midweek and weekend dates available. That's total, not eight midweek and 8 weekend dates. There are 8 total midweek and weekend dates available once you start midweek weekend from the 18th of July, and you factor in the international breaks that are proposed. So obviously, yeah, that's got to be ACL and Levain Cup have to be squeezed in there, and it's just going to be absolutely brutal, as we've said, for these players. It's going to be a festival of football, but yeah, there's definitely going to be a number of games throughout it that, you can tell that players are running on empty. And, that just adds up to what's going to be a fascinating Chaos Energy J-League season. Alex, it's been a terrific to get you back on the line. Firstly, good to hear that you're keeping well. To get your thoughts on the FC Tokyo Under-23s and the season as a whole coming up for the Gasmen in J1. So, terrific to catch up with you. And obviously, yeah, once the games start coming thick and fast, we'll be sure to be dialing you up again for your thoughts on how Tokyo get on this season. So, thanks again for your time this week.
Thanks very much, Ben. It's been great to be back.
All right, then. That is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. On behalf of Sam Robson and myself, we'd like to thank Alex Bishop, all of our supporters on Patreon, and, of course, you for listening wherever you are. We'll speak to you next week after the release of the full set of J-League fixtures. Bye for now.
The J-Talk podcast. Yes, 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 yes.